My name is Michael Ignatieff, and no, I'm not going to give you my standard LSE human rights lectures, although I noticed some of alumni, survivors of that course in the audience. It's very nice to see you again. No, this is different. This is not my standard LSE lecture course. This is something entirely different. This is arranged by BBC News, as you can see in front of me, and by the LSE. It's showing a film called Rules of Engagement, which is the third film in a series called Future War, made by some very good people who are in this audience. And they're down there. The team is down there, and I want to thank the editor, the producer, the director for doing a wonderful job. Peter Sarasol, Glenn Jones, Rebecca Seymour, everybody involved has my heartfelt thanks for this film. I'm going to take the film, this film, to West Point on Monday, and you'll understand why when you see the film, since it has a long sequence on West Point. And so the mirror will be taken to them, and they will look in the mirror, and what they make of it, God knows. But let me introduce very briefly some of the themes in this film, and then we'll run the film, and then afterwards, questions, comments from you be welcome, and I'll be happy to answer them, and then I think there's some refreshments afterwards. As I said to you before, this is part of a three-part series, two of which have been shown. This one will be shown on Saturday night at 6:45 on the BBC. The first one was about, could be called Revolution in Military Affairs, the emergence of precision guidance weapons technology that all of you have seen since the Gulf War, and which have transformed the nature of combat, made it possible to have what I call virtual war, that is, war with impunity, that is, war where you inflict casualties but you do not suffer them, where you deliver ordnance at such a distance that you're not at mortal risk. Program one was about that and the ways in which that's transforming the nature of war. The second program was about the Marines, the remaking of warrior cults in the 1990s, the toughest group of soldiers in the world reinvented themselves after Vietnam, after the catastrophe of the Beirut bombing, where 240 of them were blown up, and reinventing them in the face of what is, in a sense, a whole new set of military challenges in the 1990s, that is, the civil wars caused by fracturing and disintegrating states. The Marines are the 911 service for that kind of thing. They go into places as peacekeepers, as to evacuate American military personnel. Armies all over the world are configured to fight the Second World War. They're not configured to fight these wars of the 1990s, and much of the second film is how one particular group of soldiers, the Marines, reinvented themselves in the face of the small wars of the 1990s. Now this one, the third film, is about something completely different. It's about the new set of moral disciplines, moral and legal restraints, on the conduct of two kinds of operations. The things that are called operations other than war, that is, peacekeeping, the rules of engagement that govern peacekeeping activities, and the Geneva Convention limitations on aerial warfare, chiefly. The film makes the claim, and you'll see, that we're in the middle of what could be called a moral revolution in the conduct of warfare. On the operations other than war, on the strictly peacekeeping side, what these operations in Bosnia, in Kosovo, and Somalia have generated is an incredibly elaborate code of ethical and practical rules for the conduct of military operations in these situations. And academics and theorists on this stuff, I don't think, have looked closely enough at what the military has come up with in order to guide squaddies and soldiers in these very practical and difficult situations that are called other than war. You will see in this film, just to give you a sense of why this stuff is interesting, you'll see a training sequence in which on Salisbury Plain in which some soldiers are confronted with the following dilemma. When a guy takes a grenade out, can you fire at him if he takes the pin out and throws it at you? Can you fire at him? At what point can you use force in those situations? Now, you would think, being a civilian, and I thought the same way, that if he's got it in his hand, it's a threat. You can fire. If he throws it, it's even more of a threat. Go for him. You will discover in the film that if you did either of those things, you would be making a serious code violation. So what I'm trying to say, the key point to draw from these films, I think, is the highly counterintuitive nature of some of these rules of engagement. We're taking soldiers and we're asking them to turn on the instincts that made them soldiers in the first place. We're asking them to bottle up their aggression. We're asking them to second guess their natural defensive reactions. We're asking them to second guess the response to go and fire. And a big question emerges from this, which all military services are dealing with, which is, when you take a warrior and you do this to them, put them through a rules of engagement training, are they warriors when they come out the other side? Or have you turned them into cops, policemen, social workers? That is there some cost to us of turning our warriors and soldiers into peacekeepers? Can we turn them back, as it were? Because substantially different behavior is required in these operations other than war situations. And you will see that demonstrated. And I hope you feel what I felt when I saw it, which is a sense of a genuine dilemma. That is, we need soldiers in these places, but are we slowly eroding our military culture in the process of creating soldiers who are no longer warriors, but social workers and policemen? That's one issue raised by the film. The second issue raised by the film is the enormous growth of legal control over the exercise of war. One of the things that these ROE packages that soldiers are given, rules of engagement, they're little cards, you know, one side laminated, the other side laminated with kind of 12 do's and don'ts. They're put together by military lawyers on the basis of the Geneva Conventions. Now, the most elaborate attempt to legalize war is in the targeting process for air war. And we look in some detail at the ways in which since, to give you a capsule history of this story so that you understand why something new is happening. In 1965, during the Vietnam Air War, American military lawyers called JAGs, Judge Advocate Generals, were not allowed within a country mile of a targeting cell. The B-52s took off, the F-11s took off, they did their business, they came home. If they hit something bad, tough. Basically unconstrained military operations in 65 with, as we know, catastrophic results. Flash forward to 1989, as you'll see, we pick up the story in 1989. When the Americans go into Panama, suddenly their lawyers crawling all over the process, making all kinds of decisions, some of which we don't talk about in the film. How close can you overfly Cuba? What kinds of rules of engagement should apply when we deploy in the streets of Panama, etc. That process by which lawyers began to enter the war rooms, the planning rooms, reaches a first kind of apotheosis in 1991 in the Gulf War. You'll hear Chuck Horner, who ran the air war, talking about the ways in which the lawyers sat at his shoulder and they went through every target in Baghdad and figured out whether these were consistent with Geneva Criterion rules on the laws of war. Flash forward to 1999, to the Kosovo War, and the process is automated. When I did some reportage for the New Yorker in the summer, I was astonished to discover by a call to one of the people who ends up in this film, Tony Montgomery, that they had put the Geneva Conventions, the entire four 1949 conventions plus their protocols, on the computer. First step. Second step, they take all the lawyers who are actually sitting in a in a basement in, I think, Darmstadt, Germany, and hooked them up to the computerized target acquisition process that Wes Clark was using to select his targets for the air war. As Michael Caine says, not a lot of people know this, that the process by which targets were identified by intelligence, then they were narrowed down by the weaponeers who choose what weapon to use. They were then narrowed down further by the politicians in terms of what you can and cannot strike. At every point, there was a lawyer saying, do these fit the Geneva Convention rules on proportionality, civilian damage, mixed-use targets? You know, is this a military target or is it a civilian target, et cetera, et cetera. 500 targets were hit during that war, and all of them were reviewed by this computerized process. And Tony Montgomery, who you see in the film, spent the whole air war sitting there with this data stream going past his window, his computer window, and saying, no, you know, don't hit this bridge, don't hit that bridge, hit this power grid, but don't, you can only hit it that way. So we've got a highly legalized process of waging war, is the point this film makes. And the question for a citizen, and since, you know, we made these films, the point of making films is to raise a debate with citizens, is if you make something legal, do you make it moral? Is it enough to have the Geneva Convention's lawyers sign off on these issues? You as citizens, as people, have to make up your mind whether the fact that we have Geneva Convention compliance on these issues is a necessary and sufficient answer to the question, is this a just use of military force? So that's a second issue that we raise in the film. And the larger, and at this point I'm going to probably stop and we'll run the film, there's a larger issue kind of at the edge of this, which is the film ends with some shots of Chechnya. Nice, bloody shots. You know, T-55s pounding apartment buildings where you and I could live, you know, hitting civilians, blasting away. While the West is elaborating this highly legalistic, procedural, rule-constrained form of military violence, whose two rules are zero casualties, zero collateral damage. I mean, not rules, or desiderata. The two desiderata are zero casualties to yourself, zero collateral damage to civilians. Trying to work to a kind of technologically defined utopia in which every strike hits the target and only the target, and the target is defined and approved according to Geneva Convention criterion. That is increasingly becoming the Western way of war, partly for moral reasons that have to do with 50 years of human rights and 50 years of the Geneva Conventions, partly because the technology is a crucial driver here. What becomes technically feasible quickly becomes morally desirable. The technology is a driver, and the Americans have this driving lead in the technology. Partly because of the media, partly because of transparency. I mean, a crucial fact in this business is one of the reasons that the West is extremely concerned to be accurate is that CNN and the BBC are in Belgrade. They're in Baghdad. They were not at Dresden. They were not at Hamburg. This is a new factor, and it's a new constraint on what you can do when you wage war, because the immediate effect of a mistake gets transmitted back to your domestic public, and your domestic public doesn't like it, and that can very quickly shake the political basis upon which you can wage war in the first place. And your enemies know that. Milosevic and Saddam Hussein knew that the most effective anti-aircraft defense of their two cities was not their anti-aircraft defense, but the CNN and BBC. And this is a crucial factor in the future of war, and it pushes Western military force towards this procedural, legalized, rule-bound, and very constrained form of war, in which the bottom line is we can go to war in defense of human rights, but we are not going to go to war and die for human rights. keep the risks very, very low. Now, against this, and this gets us to Chechnya, is a Russian way of war. It's not confined to the Russians, but the Russians have given us a good example, in which the Russians, it seems to me, have concluded, looking at the Western way of war, well, the competitive advantage can't lie in out-Americaning the Americans, because we haven't got the kit. The competitive advantage lies in simply questioning all those assumptions. Who cares about casualties, and who cares about collateral damage? In fact, the legitimacy of our military power will be displayed by precisely our capacity to sustain casualties and inflict them, right? The Americans are coming into the world with a military violence whose legitimacy is always slightly in question because they're not prepared to take those kind of ultimate mortal risks. The Russians are saying, well, we haven't got the kit, we've got a low-tech army, but what we definitely can gain a competitive advantage with is if we're prepared to take and inflict casualties. And this, it seems to me, is one of the things that's going on in the Chechen campaign, not merely to smash an insurgency, but also to send a signal to Western military forces that we don't play by the rules that you're going to see in this film. And consequently, the film ends with a question, which I hope you will consider. It's a question which can be put in one form: has the West gone soft? I think that's a kind of, the kind of sexual macho elements of that are both distasteful and inaccurate. The real issue is that there are two philosophies of war competing here, two ways of using military violence to achieve political ends. And it's clear to me that if we go down the road described in this film, the competitive advantage will lie in what is called asymmetrical responses. Our competitors, our military, political, civilizational competitors, will not play the game our way. So that if we go out and fight a clean war, the smart thing to do will be to fight an extremely dirty war back. And that's one of the things that we have to think about, because one of the implications of the Kosovo campaign, I think, is a sense that American technological vulnerability gives the West such a preponderant edge in the use of precision violence that we have no competitors. I think one of the implications of the film is our competitors, the Americans' competitors, will not play the game their way. And therefore, this highly rule-bound kind of violence will be responded to with a deliberately lawless kind of violence in response. So we, as Betty Davis used to say, should fasten our seatbelts. We're going to have a bumpy 21st century. With those incendiary remarks, I would now like the film to be run. It'll run for about 50 minutes. And then afterwards, I will sit here for a while in case there are questions, comments, shouts of rage and dismay. Thanks for your attention.
The British Army is on a training exercise in the south of England. They're learning how to react when they meet trouble on the mean streets of the 21st century.
Step away from your weapon! On the floor! Tell them, get on the floor! Get the rest of them on the floor, face down! Down! Get down!
Nothing.
Soldiers used to be trained for war. Now they're learning how to keep the peace. And the new rules are far from simple.
Right. Stop! What we've seen there, everyone agree, we've seen someone getting quite a severe beating. Do we have to intervene?
Straight away, we have to intervene. We are a peacekeeping force, yeah? We've got to get involved.
In the wars of the past, the soldier wasn't paid to think. In the wars of the future, soldiering is all about thinking, making split-second judgments in violent situations. To get these judgments right, a soldier has to know his rules of engagement.
Where's the team commander there? Now, you came in there and you fired a warning shot and the pistol was there. Okay, so you're quite entitled to do that. If that pistol hadn't been there, you couldn't carry it on. Okay, you had lost the initiative then. All right? But you did carry out the right actions there. If that pistol hadn't been there, you'd have lost the plot.
In the Balkan village that the British Army has built in the English countryside to train its soldiers, a platoon is on patrol, accompanied by an interpreter. The interpreter is hit by a sniper. The men return fire. It's a natural instinct for a soldier under attack.
Give me arms! Logic, you couldn't fire!
But their instincts are wrong. They can't see the sniper, and they may hit civilians instead. The consequence could be a court-martial.
Stop!
The face of war is changing, and so is its moral code. No longer kill or be killed, no longer my country right or wrong. In the 21st century, our soldiers' rules of engagement are going to have to be as precise as their weapons. And that amounts to a moral revolution in the history of warfare.
Wars are no longer fought between states, but within them. And these are war's new victims, civilians driven from Kosovo by Serbia's soldiers and police. On the battlefields of the past, civilians were usually on the sidelines. Now they're right in the middle. So if our soldiers intervene to rescue them, the intervention has to be precise. We didn't used to intervene at all. When bad things happened in other people's countries, we said it wasn't our business. But not anymore. These images fill our TV screens and we say, something must be done. And a new generation of Western leaders has replied, something will be done.
No longer is our existence as states under threat. Now our actions are guided by a more subtle blend of mutual self-interest and moral purpose in defending the values we cherish. If we can establish and spread the values of liberty, the rule of law, human rights, and an open society, then that is in our national interest too. The spread of our values makes us indeed safer.
In Kosovo, our soldiers got a hero's welcome. But they soon discovered that keeping the peace can be more complicated than fighting a war.
Warfare today is not as clear-cut, I guess, as it used to be, because we're trying to establish political aims and change the minds, if you will, of political leadership in countries. We're trying to change ideals, and we're trying to attack nationalism and ethnic hatreds and things of that nature. It's a little different than you invaded my country, you're going to die if you don't get out.
We put our soldiers in a bind. Defend human rights, we say, but don't take any risks and don't get yourself killed.
I believe you have to be prepared, when necessary, to kill for your values. I mean, at times you are your brother's keeper. And there are times when to stop the killing, to stop the atrocity, to stop the genocide, you must be willing to kill. It's the sad paradox of mankind.
They welcome us today, but they may start shooting at us tomorrow. So are we ready to fight back, or have the mighty Western armies gone soft?
There's no question in my mind that the rich, soft Western countries that are trying to impose and uphold this new world order, that this whole approach is cruising for a massive fall. We are, in effect, the guy with a glass jaw who is wandering around the world biker bar trying to pick a fight. And somebody's going to take a swing at us, and we're going to get down like a sack of potatoes.
If waging war on the ground seems risky, why not wage it from the air with B-2 bombers? It has smart munitions which limit civilian casualties, and it flies high and invisible, so pilots aren't put at risk. It's the perfect lethal weapon for liberal democracies. The Gulf War in 1991 inaugurated the new age of high-altitude precision warfare. The general in charge of the American air campaign was Chuck Horner.
And this is my counterpart's headquarters in Baghdad. This is the headquarters of the Air Force. And keep your eye on all sides of the building as the airplane overflies the building and drops the bomb down through the center of the building.
The impact of precision munitions in modern warfare means that now we have a scalpel with which we can apply force as opposed to a sledgehammer. What that allows you to do is it allows you to identify and strike military installations that are closely adjacent to civilian. So you no longer have to bomb the entire city to get the headquarters.
Modern air power is awesome, and it's also precise, but it can't do everything. Smart bombs can take out fixed targets like headquarters, but if you want to stop people slaughtering civilians on the ground, smart bombs are next to useless.
From 30,000 feet or 15,000 feet, you don't spot, let alone stop, the rapist with a knife or the massacring soldier with the rusty Kalashnikov in the ravine. Warfare is about killing and dying. The military is not a surgical instrument. It's a sledgehammer. It's for breaking bones, for smashing in skulls. And if you are not interested in shedding blood under any circumstances and risking some of your own blood in addition to the enemy's blood, well, you might as well disband the military and just send the Red Cross.
Exercise Blue Flag at the U.S. Air Force Base in Barksdale, Louisiana. These are the targeting elite of the U.S. Air Force.
We don't know which specific aircraft.
Their job? Select the targets to attack, choose the bomb for the target, and the right plane to fly the mission. In the new age of surgical warfare, these are the surgeons. There are lawyers, too, it turns out. In the military jargon, they're called Judge Advocate Generals, or JAGs for short. Their job is to square the targets with the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions.
We have authority to strike targets in. We don't have, nobody in the AFC has authority to order any strikes in the buffer zone. If we want to strike anything within 25...
They have to keep military violence legal, and by keeping it legal, to keep it moral. JAGs have some tough calls to make.
Questions? Any targets contemplated in that area?
Military necessity is such that we do need to take that risk, assess the risk, and then set it up to hire.
Right. Okay. A lot of flights originating out.
Their dilemma here is whether they can hit an airfield that's being used for medical evacuations, medevac. The laws of war say you can't, but maybe the enemy is using medevac to conceal military operations.
Only been using for medevac purposes. If they disperse other aircraft there, well, she'll let you go right away so that you can, because then it would be a valid target in that case. But right now, it's only those curls which are being used for medevac purposes.
Right. Talking with Sergeant Bertrand.
There is a no-strike list, The question is whether the enemy is exploiting it.
Because of the fact that right now it's only being used for medevac purposes, we talked to the targeteers, they ran it up through JTF, and it's been added to the no-strike list.
Okay, I have no further questions. Anyone here have any questions?
The legal constraints that military force is placed under, I think, is an extension of our moral underpinnings and our value-based society. We are, in the United States and in all Western democracies, we are countries that respect the rule of law. The rule of law is fundamental to what we are.
All aircraft, if that's considered permissible within the law of armed conflict reference.
That's a hard question. I can't answer that.
What? Strike scenario.
But can war ever obey the rule of law? These lawyers are trying to keep violence legal, but maybe they're just trying to tie our soldiers' hands behind their backs.
While we must always attempt to wage war as morally and humanely as possible, warfare is brutal and bloody and ugly. And ugly things happen, often with the best intentions. And if you try to put every single action on a battlefield or in a bombing campaign into a strictly legal context, you will get into a morass from which you will never emerge.
The lawyers didn't get their hands on war until quite recently. The U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989 marked the first time that JAGs were in on the kill.
Operation Just Cause in Panama was a defining turning point because it did mark the beginning of active involvement by judge advocates in crisis action planning.
Clear the building, bring them out. I want some security placed on that building looking back.
We had issues that ranged from the way that we would employ particular weapons, the weapons platforms that would be employed, whether or not there was contemplated an acceptable level of collateral damage as we pursued the military objectives involved. The initial reaction was frequently, why is this lawyer trying to help us plan this campaign? But after an initial discussion, I think it was the universal experience that the JAG was very well accepted at that point.
4, 3, 2, 1, launch.
By the Gulf War in 1991, JAGs were sitting beside the generals, helping to guide cruise missiles to the right targets over Baghdad.
There were JAGs involved in several different cells within the planning organization. There were JAGs involved directly with the commander. There were JAGs down in the targeting cell, dealing directly on a day-to-day basis, determining whether or not it was an appropriate target, the correct weapon to use to take out that target, and then measuring the possible collateral consequences.
In my headquarters, I had a member of the Judge Advocate General, a lawyer, and he approved every target. He examined every target we hit and said, this is a good target or you can't hit that. Now, very seldom did we ever nominate any that we couldn't hit. But occasionally, you'd have to look at a target and say, no, this is off limits. Because, for example, a bridge that's on a dam. You can strike the bridge, but you can't strike the dam because the flooding will endanger civilians downfield. So we had a lot of those issues where we had to examine every single target. His vote held sway. He was responsible, and when he said it, that was it. Now, certainly, as a commander, I could have overridden him. But believe me, I didn't want to go to court. I did not want to be subject to legal action after the war, and so that's a very powerful tool.
Lawyers have revolutionized warfare. Over Vietnam, these B-52s could hit any target they pleased, but over Kosovo, a generation later, every bomb dropped had to be approved by a committee of lawyers. In a war fought for the sake of human rights, it was vital that every B-52 mission had to appear morally justified and legally in the clear.
I got here on the 4th of August. That week, I attended my first meeting dealing with Kosovo and issues, and it just went from there. Down at this level, it's very practical. It's what bomb are we going to put on that target? How many people are possibly going to die? What's the best time of night or time of day to hit that target? Just give you an example, maybe an industrial target, something that produces tanks. We'd look at that, and unfortunately in the modern world, a lot of sites that are good military targets are located next to civilian areas. You may have 15 buildings in that industrial complex, but you only need to hit two in order to achieve your objective. So we would hit those two targets. Those would be what are known as our DMPs, our desired mean points of impact, which is where we want the bomb to go. My input as a judge advocate would be as a bystander. If they fail to point out that there's potential for a lot of collateral damage, that we're going to injure quite a few civilians, or if they fail to consider some other factor, that's when I ask the question, if you will. It was intimidating to think that one day I would be providing input on something and two or three days later it might show up in the paper as having been destroyed. That's a sobering thought, but it makes you realize that this is not a game, this is important. You need to do your very best all the time.
The Americans justified bombing Serbian TV in Belgrade because it was broadcasting propaganda plus military signals. But the attack caused an outcry. A legal war is not necessarily a moral one. Was it right to bomb the bridges? The line between civilian and military targets, between justified and unjustified use of force, is razor thin. And some people think the lawyers are there not to hold that line, but to justify the generals when they cross it.
There is a legitimate place for law in terms of framing acceptable behavior in unacceptable circumstances, which is the catastrophe of war. On the other hand, I think the sort of appearance of the increasing importance of lawyers are sort of twofold. One is a legitimization of, if you will, our actions, that they have been approved by lawyers and therefore they are legal. And in a legalistic society, of course, that's seen as an absolutely wonderful way to justify, you know, blowing large numbers of bridges and buildings to pieces. There's an even more important thing, and I think this is really deleterious to military effectiveness, and that is sort of the desire to cover your own ass, as we Americans say.
Right, welcome to your second presentation of the day. I'm Captain Mark Fairhurst, Devon and Dorset, and for the next 2.5 hours, we'll be covering the rules of engagement. As United Nations peacekeepers...
British soldiers are learning the rules of engagement for Bosnia and Kosovo, situations which are neither peace nor war.
As the actual brokers,
the rules are designed to keep them from killing somebody by mistake. But if you're trained to kill, the rules don't seem to make much sense.
The mission is not war fighting. There is no enemy. There is, however, a threat. Now, at the outset of hostilities, the rules of engagement for Kosovo were written. It's a government white paper about yay thick an Amazonian rainforest, which wouldn't be much practical use to you. So what we have is the distilled version in a small tactical handy handout, which you keep in your pocket at all times. History is littered with examples of people that haven't operated within these guidelines and are now serving 10 years pokey for manslaughter or murder. Throughout the rest of the morning then, I'm going to cover line by line the green card, and we'll have a number of examples and demonstrations from our crack demo troops.
Withdraw!
Move!
Rewind. We'll try that one again. Does anybody think that the first action you saw there was a legitimate, justified use of firepower?
Yeah.
Yeah? Who said yeah? Raise your hand. Yeah. Whereabouts in the green card do you think that was justified?
Yeah, on the opening card here.
Yeah. 11B.
Yeah, 11B, that's it. Plants detonated throws or prepares to throw an explosive or indecent device at any of you or your person in your presence.
Does anyone think it's not an acceptable use of firepower? Okay. And the reason you can state from the green card?
You've thrown it, sir.
Okay. Thank you. So it's contentious. The grenade incident or any explosive device that's being thrown is particularly thorny. The rules are, if you see someone and you can clearly identify that they have an explosive device in their hand, up until the point that they release it from their hand, they are a legitimate target because they are causing you a threat to your life. Once they've released the grenade is now the threat to life. I'll return you to the green card if there is no other way of preventing danger. Right, the danger is from the explosion. What's the way of preventing that danger? Take cover. As I said right at the start, the green card does not allow for retrospective action. So if the man's thrown it and he's running away, you cannot open fire on the running man. Bottom line. What you can do is run him down, drop him to the ground with a rugby tackle, and arrest him.
Obeying these rules of engagement isn't easy. A soldier has to make war on the very instincts that made him a soldier in the first place. So the question is whether we should be turning our soldiers into policemen. And if we do, whether they'll lose their fighting edge.
In Kosovo, the British Army is applying the lessons it learned in Northern Ireland. Keep friendly, keep vigilant, watch your back.
Yes, okay, goodbye.
This suburb of Kosovo's capital is tense. Serbs and Roma people in an enclave surrounded by hostile Kosovar Albanians. It may not look like it, but this is dangerous work. You can't actually send policemen in here.
You see that when there were these 11 children were asleep in there?
Yeah. That, the 11 o'clock at night.
11 o'clock at night?
Uh-huh. Yeah, 11 children.
Yeah. Go, go. You have, go. Right, you have 11 children and they sleep inside?
The man with the broken window is too frightened to say who did it.
You don't know who it was broke the window? It may have been Serbian or Albanian?
No. Looking. No looking. Albanian, no. Serbish, no. Gypsy, no.
I don't know who it was. Well, tonight?
Tonight.
Yeah, I'll come down with my patrol, my soldiers. Well, all you can do is just try and fix the window. Put a bit of board on the window.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all.
Yes.
You do need soldiers to do this job, but if you turn them into peacekeepers, can you turn them back into warriors?
You can't come from an army of peacekeepers into a serious war-fighting army overnight. You can do the reverse just about overnight. Within peace support operations, there are some other things required which you don't necessarily need when you're war-fighting, not least of which is the ability to engage with the people amongst whom you are carrying out this peace support operation. These two things, they're not in competition, but if you only train for the peacekeeping element, you can't get up there without an awful lot of effort and a lot of time.
Hello, Kosovo, this is DJ Jersey Tom once again, and you are listening to Falcon FM 92.7, the only radio station for this crazy Balkan nation, am I right?
Yeah.
Rock on, Kosovo!
Camp Bonsteel, home for the 5,000 American soldiers in southern Kosovo. When America comes in, it comes in heavy. But even the biggest military force in the world finds itself stretched too thin, worrying that in defending values, it's neglecting its core business, defending U.S. interests.
The military today is being asked to prepare for everything from waging the ultimate war to feeding people in Bangladesh during some sort of natural disaster.
So say, see you later, alligator. See you later, alligator.
And they have to be good at all of it. Because they're human beings, they can only concentrate on so much. And the core tasks of military culture, they have to be trained for with a sense of urgency and a sense of focus, because they're the hardest ones, and ultimately, they are the task at which the military cannot fail. You can muddle through or muck up 100 Haitis and Somalias and Kosovos, and a great nation won't pay a price for it in terms of its status in the world or the freedom of its citizens. But if you fail at one of the larger conflicts, you failed the nation. You failed the only reason the military exists.
And the military has worries about its political leaders. They're the ones who give the orders. But do they have the guts to use military power decisively? Most have never served in the armed forces. They grew up in the 1960s, when all you needed was love.
The problem we have is this governing elite, they're children of the 60s. They grew up idealizing mankind and imagining that the age of Aquarius might come. I am concerned about naive leaders. And in both our countries, we are unlikely to have future presidents or prime ministers who have served. So I do believe it is a duty for anyone who wants to be president or prime minister to at least educate themselves about the military. The average general or admiral has more years of formal training than a brain surgeon. Well, no president or citizen would imagine going into the operating room and telling the surgeon how to operate because they've seen a movie about surgeons or a TV show. And yet everybody's an armchair general. And past a certain point, always with oversight, you've got to be willing to trust your military to do what it has trained for so long to do.
Admiral Leighton Smith knows all about the problems of trusting and being trusted by your political leaders. In 1995, he commanded NATO troops in Bosnia.
Well, is this the right place to be?
Yes, sir.
Let me just tell you that we're on a roll, that we are seeing successes far beyond what we had imagined we would see. All three of the parties.
Before we went into Bosnia, I said, tell me what it is I'm supposed to do. Give me the rules of engagement to do it and the troops trained to do it, and you won't have a problem with me.
In August 1995, he was given clear orders: stop Serbian aggression and force them to the negotiating table by bombing an agreed range of military targets.
We developed the target list, and we had been given some very, they were good guidelines in terms of what targets we could hit. There was very little doubt in my mind what I could and what I could not hit.
Smith's airmen hit their targets all right. The problem was the Serbs didn't fold.
As we got into the campaign, the Serbs obviously didn't yield. They just kind of hunkered down. And I was beginning to run out of targets. And I came back to my boss and I said, we're running out of targets. I need a greater latitude. I was told no. Apparently that information was transmitted back to Washington, and my own government accused me of lying about the target shortage. Now, you know, what in God's name would I lie about something like that for?
The bombing continued, but the target list didn't actually make any military sense. At least not to the admiral running the show.
It was suggested to me that perhaps I might want to go back and hit some of the targets that we had previously struck, because that would keep the bombing operation going. And, you know, this is bombing for the press, not bombing for effect. And I said, no. Military people are obligated, in my view, to plan for the worst and pray for the best. I fear many times politicians plan for the best and hope they are right. Hope is not a course of action.
Leighton Smith's NATO command in Bosnia was to be his last. He'd learned some bitter lessons about taking orders from today's politicians.
I give talks from time to time at war colleges. And one of the things that I try to tell the young officers as they grow, you are not a politician. You were not trained as a politician. You don't eat like one, sleep like one, think like one, talk like one. And that's not all bad. It's just a fact of life. And what I tell these young military officers, if you're not completely honest with the political leadership when talking about developing a mission and or but developing a plan, then you deserve whatever the hell you get.
United States Military Academy, West Point, New York. Here, the United States Army trains its officer elite. The rules of engagement in modern war may be changing, but West Point still trains its officers in the old values, duty, honor, and country, and in the old traditions, drills, march pass, and parades. But change is now sweeping through West Point. For new wars and new threats, a new officer class is needed.
The 21st century leader really needs to be very, very comfortable with uncertainty and ambiguity. We try to make sure junior leaders, senior leaders, are comfortable thinking and acting outside the box. We've tried to get away somewhat dramatically from this notion that the only proper answers are yes, sir, no, sir, no excuse, sir, and sir, I do not understand. That's not the environment that we want officers, NCOs, and our soldiers to be operating in. We want them comfortable with uncertainty, able to operate in the middle of absolute chaos.
For two centuries, Western military culture believed that the best way to turn out officers was to turn them into machines. West Point took this to extremes.
When I came to West Point, we were being led by harsh and tyrannical treatment. It was supposed to be a character developing experience. The idea was that we would be broken down and to nothing. And then the institution would build us back to be this wonderful person of integrity and honor who could be tough and lead in battle. What you had was a two-class system where you had the upper class and then you had the plebs. And the plebs were expected to be perfect in all things. And as soon as you showed a mark of imperfection, you basically got your ass royally reamed.
Civilians were hard put to understand how West Point's particular rituals were supposed to turn cadets into officers.
Hey, Mr. Taylor.
Yes, sir. Don't you think that was an awful big bite again?
Sir, I do not know.
Oh, I do, you understand?
Yes, sir.
Let's have a stuff button poop, Taylor.
Zowie, Zowie, Zowie. Sir, I'm a stuff gut. This is my right big boot. This is my left big hook. This is my two big hooks extended and joined. Would anyone care for more to eat before I eat the table?
That's leadership? That's leadership development? I'm sorry, I don't think so.
Cadets had to stick close to the walls to obey orders, no matter how crazy.
Did I learn anything productive that made me a better officer? Absolutely not. Back in my day, you could tell somebody, this is what we want you to do. We would accept it at face value. This generation is different. For us to say something that makes great sense without reason is just not going to be accepted by this generation of young men and women. They're going to question it. And if we want them to believe in duty, honor, and loyalty to country, it's going to take more than just saying, this is our motto, believe it, and do it. We have to explain it to them.
Section attention. Sir, section form, one cadet absent.
Okay, take seats. All right. Anybody going Navy this weekend?
In the 1990s, West Point started to close the gap between its rituals and those of campus life in the civilian world outside.
You know what the best part about this weekend is? I get to see a brigade review. Well, I'm actually in the parade. It's my 10-year reunion, so all you guys better look good.
The leadership mantra now is, treat your people with respect and they'll respect you. Blind obedience is finished for the warrior elites of the 21st century.
I tell you that, you know, think about that and the impact that you want to make as a lieutenant and as a platoon leader from an impression management standpoint. Now, you know, do you want to run around threatening to fire people if they don't do it your way? Probably not a good idea. But the important thing is what kind of...
The class is teaching them how to communicate with subordinates and learning to accept it when the sergeant talks back.
You're going to walk into a platoon and you're going to meet your platoon sergeant. What's that relationship going to be like at first? What do you think it'll be like?
So the way I see it, you know, the way I've always imagined it when I first meet my platoon sergeant, you know, I'll be walking one way, no, LT, go that way. You know, slap me on the back and point me in the right direction.
Okay, yeah, and you know, a good platoon sergeant will do that. So yeah, the relationship, the parallel between what you just saw is kind of similar to the relationship you're going to have with your platoon sergeant. You know, don't expect your platoon sergeant to say, hey, welcome aboard. I mean, maybe they will. Maybe kind of like Imani was talking about, you kind of feel each other out, see what each other's all about. Does the LT have the best interest in mind? And chances are, platoon sergeant will have the best interest of the platoon in mind.
Chow time has changed too. If the cadets weren't wearing uniforms, you might think this was a university dining hall. But can a university campus train warriors to fight?
We look at the challenges of a future officer. We know that these officers are going to have to be warriors. There's a character component of this. There's also a training component. You have to be technically skilled as a warrior. You also have to develop people who are able to master a body of knowledge and to become expert.
Yes, sir.
Not amateurs, but expert at the fighting of a war.
He said, in order to make it harder, try to do it with type positives instead of floats.
Every cadet who comes to West Point is issued a computer so that they can understand the information age that we are all in. The computer is not going to replace the rifle. The computer is not going to replace face-to-face leadership. The computer is just there as a supplement. It hasn't replaced the fundamental things that make a military leader or a soldier or a warrior.
Saturday afternoon, and West Point is out in force for the peacetime equivalent of war, football.
Come on, man.
The notion that we are instilling into our ethic respect and consideration of others, and that that would somehow impurify the warrior ethic, I think is really off base. What we do is to blend the notion of courage and physical prowess on the battlefield with a companion ethic that says you also treat subordinates humanely, you treat non-combatants civilly, you abide by the laws of war. There's nothing incongruent between the ethic on the one hand that says you'll be a warrior, and on the other hand that says you'll treat your subordinates and non-combatants civilly. That's really all that we're trying to do here.
The problem is that football may be the closest these cadets ever come to feeling the raw aggression of real combat. West Point exists to train leaders for combat, but do its cadets still have what it takes to prevail on the battlefield?
The real success of Western military institutions since the early 17th century has been the capacity to take that barbarian spirit and discipline it and organize it, both on the battlefield and off the battlefield, persuading young men, also young women, to stay in places where every natural instinct tells them it's time to leave, and provides them, if you will, the capacity to stay there and do their job under the most terrifying and terrible of circumstances. And I think we're beginning to lose touch with that sense in the American military of what military culture is about.
West Point crushes its opponent, but far away from the astroturf and the cheerleaders, there are warriors who are playing for real. In the West, we talk of war as if it were laser surgery. In Chechnya, war is what it's always been, a bloody and chaotic test of wills where people suffer and die. Kill or be killed. If it moves, destroy it. If it stands, level it to the ground. If in doubt, wipe it out. These are war's eternal rules. The only lives that matter are your own. And if civilians get in the way, that's just too bad. Our dilemma is this. If we fight as gentlemen against a ruthless enemy, we risk defeat. If we fight as barbarians, our victories will be empty ones.
If we were willing to throw out the laws of war, then yes, we could win all the time. Whether we win or lose is going to depend on your definition of what do you mean by win. And I would say we win if we do not become like our enemy at the end of the day. We could always win if we were willing to throw out any of the restrictions we've posed upon us. That means we've lost, in my view.
One of the big dangers of the future is that we'll lose that edge, that hardness, that toughness, and that we'll become the soft society that is then attacked at many different points by the hard and hungry societies of the world. It's a historical pattern familiar to all of us, and it's been responsible for the rise and fall of many empires. We often wonder if we're next.
At the very time that we have become obsessive about the value of each human life, many of our enemies truly have little regard for lives other than their own. This sense of responsibility for the lives of others that permeates Western civilization just doesn't exist in much of the world. It's a bloody, brutal place out there, and you just don't see it from the comfort of your home in Northern Virginia or Sussex.
Warriors can't afford to get soft, and we civilians can't let them either. Back in Britain, the parachute regiment seems to have a pretty good idea of what war is really all about.
Front there! Doorway to the right! Doorway forward!
Liberal democracies may seem soft, but we still have warriors who are prepared to fight and die in our name. Soldiers take their orders from us, from the citizens, and those orders need to be clear.
If we're confused about what military power can achieve, if we send them on assignments that are unclear, they'll pay the price for our confusions, but so will we. There you have it.
I'm here as your target. Questions, comments, thoughts, suggestions. We've got about 15 minutes, I think. Yeah. Just shout. Two good questions. Second one first. To the best of my knowledge, no conditions. We did a lot of B-2 filming at Whiteman, Missouri, ourselves. I am unaware of any conditions put on us as a film crew. I'm looking anxiously at my producers to see whether that's right. Clearly, the BBC could not make a film if it accepted conditions which infringed our editorial independence. We interviewed people. Many of those interviews were 55 minutes long. We picked the bits that we wanted to run. The commandant of West Point had no say in the final cut. So I don't feel that the editorial independence of the product was compromised, and I wouldn't have taken part had it been. On the first question, I think that the question makes a series of assumptions which I'd want to question. One of them is that, you know, liberal nice guys shouldn't say anything good about soldiers. I think that's just the wrong set of assumptions for the following reason. In some sense, yes, I have changed, but let me explain why. I don't think there's any reason why liberal nice guys can't talk about military power. The real reason has to do with the fall of Yugoslavia. From 1991 onwards, I was one of those who called as a journalist and as a writer and someone who was in and out of the region for decisive military action by the West to stop what seemed to me to be, you know, horrendous ethnic cleansing of civilians, for one thing, armed subversion of a independent state, you know, Bosnia, a number of other things. I wanted military action taken. What gradually dawned on me, and I think should dawn on most human rights activists who call for military intervention, and we call for it not to kind of impose the Western way of life on the Balkan peninsula, but simply to defend civilians from what looks like massacre. The problem with the Something Must Be Done Brigade, of which I am a charter, fully paid up liberal member, is we don't know a single thing about military power when it comes to it. There's a complete disconnect between human rights principles and goals and values, definitions of moral ends, and military means. Now, why military? I mean, most of the time I think human rights ends shouldn't be pursued by military means. I think military means should only be pursued when there are no other means available, when all diplomatic means have exhausted, when all forms of persuasion have been exhausted, when sanctions have been exhausted. Military means to be legitimate in the first place should only be the last resort. But the thing that strikes me very much among all my kind of liberal human rights friends, they don't know anything about military power. They don't know what military power can and cannot do. And there's a disconnect between the community calling for military action and the military community that's actually supposed to do it. Throughout the Bosnian campaign, people were saying, you know, first of all, send in military teams to protect the delivery of humanitarian relief. Well, that was a crazy mission. It ended up with UNPROFOR's, you know, military legitimacy being in shreds. You know, people then said, bring the military in to protect civilians. So we had safe havens, and 10,000 people got killed in Srebrenica as a result of the inability, in my view, to match human rights principles like the protection of civilians in zones of conflict with adequate military means to do so. I mean, in retrospect, you know, the blame for Srebrenica, which is the thing that obsesses me, is not just, you know, the UN, the Dutch government, the Dutch military, the Dutch commander on the ground. It's the whole human rights community that signed up to the proposition of safe havens under military defense without attending to the details like rules of engagement, close air support, armor, the whole kit and caboodle. The reason I do these talks and will do it forever is I never want us to make human rights promises using military power that we can't keep. Because in Srebrenica, 10,000 people got massacred because we didn't get it right, right? Now, flash forward to Kosovo, you know, I felt I was a proponent of military action in Kosovo, but I feel that many of the military actions we took in Kosovo made the problem worse. I think many of the use of air power at 15,000 feet could not achieve the goals that we set to achieve. So then you say, we should have had ground troops. Well, okay, what ground troops? You see, what I want is a responsible public discourse by human rights activists like myself. People who said, let's have ground troops, didn't have the faintest idea what ground troops we're talking about. If you gave that assignment to the military, the American army said, right, we have to pay, excuse me, we have to pave Albania. You do realize that, don't you? We have no landing stages in Albania that could sustain, you know, an invasion force. So we'll pave Albania. That'll take 6 months. Then we have to have, because of the mountainous terrain and conditions, we have to have 175,000 troops. Do you know how long that takes to deploy, right? So here you have human rights liberals saying, do something about the poor, suffering Kosovars. And the Pentagon quite rightly saying, well, what exactly did you have in mind? And then you say, well, do something that is a dissuasive threat to Milosevic. They say, what about the time problem? Do you realize how long it takes to deploy? It takes 3 months to get these guys into theater. 6 months before they're ready to fire a shot, right? Now, I'm loading you with the detail here to make a point, which is that I'm not a pro-war guy at all. I'm an anti-war guy because the first political action of my whole life was against the Vietnam War. I'm not against interventions because of that, unless I feel there are strong, clear humanitarian reasons for doing so. But if you're going to make a humanitarian case, you bloody well better get the military side right. That's my whole case. Or don't do it. Don't go in there. And one of the final problems, one of the reasons why it's worth making films about this, is I think the public is fantastically ignorant about, you know, military detail. It's not a criticism of the public. It's the fact that military debate and military argument is conducted by a very, very small elite in this country, in Chatham House, in RUSI, in IISS, right? And I just think these things are really too important to leave to the lawyers, they're too important to leave to the politicians, and they're definitely too important to leave to the generals. So in my kind of small way with this team, that's why I feel strongly about this. So that we don't... I can sum it up in a sentence. Let us never make military promises to protect endangered civilians that we cannot keep with adequately staffed military means. That's my mantra. And, you know, I've had to learn an awful lot about the military side so that I feel that when I'm making promises or advocating things, I know what the hell I'm talking about. That's where it all comes from. Back row. Sorry, I don't understand the second question.
Target of opportunity, of all the issues to a military officer in combat when an adjutant general is not present.
Yeah.
Target of opportunity.
Well, my understanding, and I invite correction from anybody who knows more about this, is that for various reasons, first of all, it was difficult to process targets of opportunity in the Kosovo War, particularly, because of tight political and legal controls, guys flying missions couldn't say, "Ah, there's a nice little target here," and just take it out. They had to be extremely careful about that. So their rules of engagement, I think, restrained gratuitous target acquisition on the fly. In that situation, they had to fly a track, do it, and go. There were other reasons which had to do with the management of airspace. I mean, if you're up there, you're flying patterns, you can't, your opportunity to engage targets of opportunity was limited. And my sense was that as the campaign proceeded, a lot of pilots wanted to take on more targets of opportunity, wanted more flexibility, and the air tasking system in real time wasn't able for them to do that. So my sense is that there was rather little target of opportunity stuff. And that raises a general issue down the road about initiative. In another context, one of the battles that we looked at very closely in an earlier film was the Battle of 73 Easting, a tank battle during the Gulf War, the most important tank battle since the Second World War. It lasted about 5 minutes, and it was, you know, a decisive American victory. One of the little details about that battle is that it wouldn't have happened at all had the American military tank commanders not proceeded beyond their grid reference. I mean, had they obeyed strict rules of engagement, strict grid reference rules, the battle might not have occurred. It wasn't exactly a target of opportunity, that is, they had an assignment to engage this enemy, but the enemy wasn't where the planners said it was, so they had to proceed slightly forward. So the broad issue is what discretion is consistent with tight rules of engagement. That's how I construe your question. And my understanding of what's going on out there is that discretion is under very, very tight wraps, because they don't, because political and military commanders don't want this thing to spiral out of control. But discretion is what makes for heroism. It what makes for decisive breakthroughs. Discretion can make the difference between victory and defeat. So if you have rules of engagement that eliminate discretion utterly, you may have an army that's unable to respond fast. I'm improvising that question. I hope I haven't said something that's radically inaccurate. Yeah. Yeah. I think that bridge point is well taken. I think that we'll live with the economic and social consequences and the diplomatic fallout of those bridge decisions for a long time. I think people are waking up to the ways in which that hit the economic infrastructure of the whole Danube basin. So it impacted right along a chain in ways that I think that the military planners should have understood better. I take that point. The Serbian TV station is much more complicated business, because it was hit at 2 a.m. and my understanding, on the basis of having been in Belgrade myself, is that that place was an evident target for days before. Serbian military intelligence knew it was a target, and the place was deliberately staffed to create a collateral damage incident. Well, 15 journalists died, and my source for this is not some tendentious Western propagandist, but angry Serbian journalists who felt very deeply that, you know, innocent people were suckered into a devious political operation. I mean, because the bombing was very, very weird bombing. We pretend to bomb you, you pretend to, you know, resist, as it were. There was a tremendous amount of shadow play in which I think NATO pretty well informed, either through public or private channels, the Serbian military that a lot of targets were up to be hit, including the television station. The fact that 15 people were there just simply wasn't a military mistake by the West, because the building could easily have been evacuated. In fact, what's made the Serbian journalists so angry was that many of the bosses of the Serbian TV, you know, chose to take the night off. One of them famously leaving his vest jacket on the back of a chair where the poor old makeup girl didn't get tipped off.
That's my point. If you bomb a TV station at 2 a.m, you will not get the bosses to the TV station.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're home. The Belgrade
is. Yes. Well, it was clearly a mistake, but it highlights what makes this modern form of warfare such a complicated game. Because you can play, you can select your target very carefully and still play into a collateral damage incident. That's point one. Point two, which is not a point made in the film, but which I think is very, very important, especially for a British audience, is that British military planners had substantial legal and moral doubts about the Serbian TV strike. It's important that the public realizes that it's not as if the Geneva Conventions is a cookbook in which all men and women come to the same conclusion. The point is, the British thought this target stank from a legal, political, and moral point of view and didn't fly the missions. The Americans did. There was very substantial argument about these very questions at the heart of the alliance. One of the reasons that I think the alliance became a virtual alliance, not a real one, was that in fact, because of these disagreements, the French didn't like the bridge targets, didn't like any of them. The British didn't like the TV station. The British didn't like the power grid target. That at the end of the day, the Americans simply, what happened was that various allies would simply say, we will not run, we will not fly tonight. If you want to do it, you do it, but we won't do it. It's one of the forces that drove the level of American involvement up into the 90% range, simply because they read the Geneva Conventions this way and were prepared to go, and Europeans were not. So that there's a huge argument here about the legality and morality of this kind of targeting. And my view is that this argument should be out in the open. It shouldn't be held down within the alliance. Question, right there. I think that the points you're making are well taken, and Kosovo, I think, was a dire learning experience for all Western electorates faced with claims that, you know, high-precision weapons can do it for us. It was clear that high-precision weapons were astoundingly successful at what they were asked to do. It was a military success, but not necessarily a political one, and it did not prevent the ethnic cleansing that we're talking about. And there are a lot of cases where precision weapons can't respond at all to the needs you're actually facing. In East Timor, what would precision weapons do? I mean, against small gangs of Indonesian militiamen. This is also the problem, that it's not merely that we have a risk-averse military culture now. We don't have a military culture that is training to engage with these specific kinds of threats, like the Indonesian military, like Somalia is a good example. In Somalia, as the film, one of our early films shows, the Americans' army was pursuing the factional leader Farah Aidid in Mogadishu in 93. They had everything. They had dominant battle space awareness. They had helicopters up top. They had, I think, an AWACS or something providing perfect signaling right throughout the whole battlefield of Mogadishu. They sent some Rangers and Delta Force people to snatch this, not even Aidid himself, but some of his people. The video technology tells a very, very large story. They had video cameras in the helicopters as the Rangers abseiled down to land on the roofs of buildings to begin this operation to take some of Aidid's people to capture them. As they went down the abseil ropes, the rotor began to kick up dust off the roofs of Mogadishu and completely cover the landing site, so that nobody had realized that Mogadishu is very dusty, that when you put the rotor blades in low enough, you can't see a damn thing. battle space awareness disappeared within 35 seconds of the beginning of the mission. Then hubris comes into play because they didn't bring their night vision goggles. And they got into a night firefight without night vision, right? They had to fight themselves out the hard way. 18 people died and something like 700-800 Somalis fighting them died. So two helicopters went down and an entire mission had to be withdrawn and extracted. So the message of that is not merely that the technology doesn't work in these situations, but that, you know, American military training, British military training is not often configured for this kind of mission. I mean, to a degree that still shocks me, the American Army is still training for Desert Storm. If you go to Fort Irwin, California, they run Desert Storm, they run tank battles over and over again. They get better and better at tank battles in a world where their real threat is small militiamen with AK-47s and, you know, ethnic cleansers moving house to house. So there is a disconnect, in other words, between what the military trained to do and what the threat is in these peace enforcements and operations other than war. I exempt the British because the British have the painful experience of Northern Ireland and have got extremely good, probably the best counterinsurgency, low-intensity operation troops in the world. But I don't see the same capability in the U.S. Army. The Marines are another story. The Marines have realized that this is their window of opportunity. I've silenced you. So, question? The Falklands thing you mentioned is very interesting because it seems to me that casualties were undertaken on the basis this was a defense of a vital national interest because it was a piece of sovereign British real estate. And so there was a sense that all the old language of ultimate commitment could be cranked up. National interest, national honor, and also another crucial thing, which is territorial invasion by one state of another peace state, so that the legal, you know, the kind of United Nations charter, UN charter basis for resistance were all squared away. But I think the hard fact is that the difference between America and Europe is less than you imply. I mean, there is some difference in the sense that for any foreign power to capture, humiliate, or kill an American soldier is just worth a lot more in brutal terms than it is to kill, injure, humiliate a British or French. So the stakes are higher for the Americans. But I think the thing that's painful to face up to if you're a kind of human rights activist and you believe that when people are being massacred, deported, brutalized in another state, and you believe there's a case for military intervention, the hard fact is that the political consensus, the democratic political consensus in support of casualty taking in that area of human rights and humanitarian intervention, the consensus is paper thin, in my judgment. And I think that's an issue that human rights activists have to confront honestly. We live in a democracy. We're asking, you know, soldiers to pay with their lives to defend values that we take for granted as being of ultimate value. If that's going to work, we have to convince our fellow citizens that that's a price worth paying. And so far, I don't think we've been able to do that. It's not to say that the British public or the European public is kind of parochial, provincial, isolationist. There was very, very strong, genuine feeling, I think, about Kosovo. But people made a very clear, I think quite clear-headed view. We should do something, but not everything. And I think that's where the consensus lies. And that's why I think that the zero casualty rule is a quite stable feature of the future. That is, I think people are not going to risk troops in defense of human rights. They're prepared to risk them when something absolutely essential is at stake. And I think most people do not yet feel that human rights are indivisible and that what happens in Kosovo happens to us in some intimate way. I just don't think that's where we are, and human rights activists have to face that. So the zero casualty rule is fixed. I also think the zero collateral damage, the corollary, is also fixed simply because people, you know, it's interesting, you know, 10 years of demonizing the Serbs and demonizing the regime and there's a tremendous amount of hatred towards Serbs, and Serbs living in London feel it like a kind of hot pressure all the time. 10 years of it didn't really anesthetize the European public to the sight of people being killed on the other side of the battle line. There are very, very strict limits to how you can demonize a population. We seem to be able to demonize a regime and demonize leaders, but not populations. And as soon as you put cameras in there, it just raises the political tariff, the political cost of making mistakes. So I think both of these, the zero casualty, zero collateral rule, is structural to how we're going to have to do this stuff, I think. I have reduced you all to silence. One more question, one more thought? You've had one. Does anybody have a question there?
Can you imagine the development of a church which is used to reach your military people and not have the military control producing these
things? Well, I think there's one of the things that everybody's saying about the catastrophe in Kosovo is how underdeployed we are in what's called CIVPOL. That is, all of the nations have been asked to provide police and military police, and we just don't have enough. We don't have enough peacekeepers. I don't think the British public is aware of how tightly stretched the British Army is now, even how tightly stretched the American Army is. The Canadian Army is all over the bloody shop. I mean, just and absolutely at its limit. The Australians ditto. I've just come back from Australia and New Zealand. What's interesting here is the ways in which human rights language is pushing governments into deployments everywhere, and they don't have the bodies because they're spending, 1.6% of GDP on national defense. It's just not enough. And we're facing a crunch between human rights commitments and what we're prepared to stump up and pay all over the Western world. And we're not going to get effective military deployments either in peacekeeping or in CIVPOL unless we're prepared to put more money in the defense budget, which is not a popular sell at a time when the health service is in trouble and blah, blah, blah. Domestic expenditure will always have a priority over military one. But if that's the case, then we got to stop talking this human rights talk because we haven't got the guys to do the job. One of the cheaper ways to respond directly to your question, it's obviously cheaper to send a civilian policeman than it is to send a bulked up, guy with Kevlar helmets and the whole 9 yards of military deployment. But we haven't developed, and it's an urgent task, we haven't developed a kind of rapid reaction CIVPOL force in which you simply take policemen off the beat in London, policemen off the beat in Saskatoon, policemen off the beat in Adelaide and Sydney, and you train them in international deployments. They have 6 months secondments. They do it and they come back. It's a fantastic thing to do. It's fantastically rewarding and useful. If we could develop that kind of capacity, it would, I think, also make for better policemen when they came home, and they would be very good on the ground. But again, there are limits. There are limits to what CIVPOL can do. In the film, I said, that scene where the guy goes in and, the guy talks about his busted window. These things can turn crazy so fast you just don't know what hit you. So you send in CIVPOL guys who've got a sidearm, and suddenly they're taking fire, and they haven't got radios, and they can't spread some fire out, they can't throw smoke, they can't do any of the things that soldiers can do. So we're unclear as to the point at which you situations have calmed down enough so you can put CivPol in, or whether you have to, you know, at what point you have to stay with peacekeepers. We haven't worked that out. But that's the frontier. I mean, just to conclude, I owe my, you know, in 1993 when I was in Croatia, I mean, I just saw, they happened to be Canadians, but, you know, Mounties who, you know, used to be traffic cops in Saskatoon, handing out tickets on the highways on Saturday night, and they'd been deployed to Croatia. And what were they doing? They were escorting families across a demarcation line to visit their graves in enemy territory and then back. Was this more rewarding than handing out traffic tickets in Saskatoon on a Saturday night? You bet. So that's a place we can go. But I don't think there's an international capability to do that yet. I've talked you all into silence. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming. I enjoyed the discussion and the reaction to the film. Yes, I've just been handed a message. If there drinks will be served for all of you in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor. You go to those elevators and you go right up to the fifth floor, and we can give you a drink. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your attention.